Okay, good evening, everybody. Our topic for tonight is Jewish Harlem. This was the PhD dissertation of my professor, Jeffrey Gurak, which he wrote in the late 1970s at Columbia, in which he studied the uptown Jewish community and tried to show that the experience of the Jews uptown sort of disproved certain theories about the immigrant experience in the United States and the nature of Americanization among newly arrived ethnic groups, that not everybody has the same experience, whether in this, because it's a different city or because it's a different ethnic group. Okay, so prior to 1865, very few Jews ventured north of 42nd Street. It was essentially a no man's land up there, uncultivated rural territory. The first Jewish gathering in Harlem took place in 1869 to discuss the possibility of organizing Sabbath and holiday services. From this, in 1873, emerged Congregation Hand in Hand. What kind of a synagogue was this? Well, you could guess that those Jews who lived 10 miles north of their brethren downtown were not necessarily the most pious old world types. And so it wasn't going to be a rigorously Orthodox synagogue. There was mixed seating. Why? Not out of ideological zeal for reform, but simply because there was no gallery available in the room in the building that they rented. So sometimes necessity creates what becomes then the, sort of the doctrine. They introduced an organ in 1877, and that's a bit too far for the traditionalists. So the Orthodox broke away, and they established Congregation Tents of Israel. Ohalei Yisrael, another split, further reduced and weakened Congregation Hand in Hand. And they still had to use rented space until the early 1880s. They couldn't build their own building. But they did succeed in doing something very important in the Harlem Jewish experience, and that is educating Jewish children. What was established was the Sha'arei Limud Talmud Torah, a free religious school, which ended up being the forerunner to Temple Israel's Hebrew Free School of Harlem. And in 1880, it had 200 students. Sorry, 200 students is a substantial number. We're not talking about the tiny little community. It's growing. It's growing significantly. The community needed to buy a burial plot because they no longer had associations downtown. And so they bought a plot in Bayside in Queens. And then when that filled up, they bought a plot in Lower Westchester, not far from here in New Rochelle. And this was the communal life in the 1880s. The Harlem YMHA was established in 1879, and the Harlem Lodge of B'nai B'rith was established in 1882, and it gave Jews leisure time activities for Jews of all convictions. So the question was, the first residents of Harlem were German or Central European? So they were German Jews for the most part, who were leaving the downtown area and the lower midtown area for a more convenient life away from the squalor of overcrowded lower Manhattan. So these leisure organizations were established, but some of them had very little to do with Judaism. And so, for example, the YMHA infamously scheduled a leisure boat ride on the East River for Tisha B'Av, and they had to be told to consult the Jewish calendar the next time you make a field trip. The question was, how do you get people with a minimal attachment to Judaism to stay involved in Jewish life some way? And that will be a long time question affecting Jewish communities all over the place, but especially in Harlem. Jews were integrated very early into the larger Harlem community. They participated in civic life and in philanthropic activities for the general well-being, not just the Jewish community. And they experienced almost no anti-Semitism. There was one incident in 1899 of a certain Macher who was kept out of the Harlem Club, but basically there was no anti-Semitism to speak of uptown north of 96th Street. During the 1880s, Harlem was a sparsely populated, semi-rural settlement. But that came to an end very quickly. It was true from the 1860s, 1870s into the early 1880s, and then it came to an abrupt end. Why did it end? Because the elevated trains, the L's, the 2nd Avenue and the 3rd Avenue were completed and went to the tip of Manhattan in 1879 and 1880, respectively. So commuter problems were a minor annoyance compared to the terrible overcrowding downtown. So if you wanted to have a better life, you put up with having a longer commute and living in a pleasant environment rather than a dingy environment below Houston Street. So if not for the expansions, the trains were built at a critical time in the history of New York City, critical time, because the pogroms in Eastern Europe, which began in 1881, led to the rapid departure of large numbers of Jews to the United States. And if not for the expansion of residential neighborhoods in Harlem and in elsewhere to siphon off Irish and German from the Lower East Side, then New York City would not have been able to accommodate the flood of new arrivals. So this is of critical importance. We take for granted that New York was able to absorb a lot of Jews, okay? And we are the end result of that, having absorbed a lot of Jews. But if the downtown was the only part of the city that was inhabitable and there weren't other neighborhoods, then the veteran residents would not have been able to leave and the greenhorns wouldn't have been able to come in. So it's only because these other communities developed in northern Manhattan and in Brooklyn that this was at all possible. Okay, so the Irish and the German leave. The Irish go to the West Side. The Germans go to Yorkville. And all types go to Harlem, Jews included. The poor ones go to East Harlem. The moderately affluent ones go to the brownstones near Lexington Avenue. And the wealthy ones go to northwestern Harlem on the upper reaches of Fifth Avenue. So with a newfound sense of financial security because of the arrival of many more Jews, congregation hand in hand was able to establish itself as Temple Israel of Harlem and build a big edifice on 125th Street and Fifth Avenue in 1888. And then in 1902, build a building on 120th and Lenox Avenue, Lenox being essentially Sixth Avenue, for those who aren't familiar. Now, Dr. Maurice Harris was the rabbi. He was a moderate reform rabbi. At first, they used the Minhag Jastrow, which was a middle-of-the-road historical school sitter. Then they switched over to the Union Prayer Book of Reform. But even though it was Reform, they kept the second day of Yontif. How do you like that? They kept the second day of Yontif, and you were allowed to wear a yarmulke. In plenty of real doctrinaire Reform places, you couldn't put on a yarmulke. They'd kick you out. So it was trying to accommodate a variety of people, a variety of Jews. Well, the new rail links hastened the demise of the Harlem branches of the B'nai B'rith and YMHA, because they became duplicate and superfluous, that their constituents had quick access to these things downtown. You didn't need a separate ranch uptown. What about the shuls? So several shuls were established in Harlem in the 1890s, typically moving from downtown to uptown. For example, Shaarei Tzedek moved to 118th Street from Henry Street in 1897. There's a question, what were their jobs and where did they work? Okay, so the answer is, for the most part, Jews who moved up to Harlem did not commute back downtown, but rather they worked in Harlem. The jobs were primarily not the needle trades works, because the needle trades moved to Brooklyn or stayed in downtown Manhattan. In Harlem, there was a significant percentage of buildings trades Jews, mostly in alterations rather than in new construction. They were also just shopkeepers and white collar professionals and people who had extra kesef in their pockets. They were rich. It was West Harlem. So it was a wide range of things, but interestingly, not so much the needle trades. Okay. By the first Russian shul to be established in Harlem was in 1891, Nachlas Tzvi. And the Uptown Talmud Torah, which we'll speak more about soon, was established in 1892. By the early 1900s, Russian Jews constituted the overwhelming majority of Harlem's Jewish residents, which means that the German Jewish period of dominance in Harlem was very short-lived. And this was something that Professor Gurak was able to sort of debunk in the popular imagination, that there's this thinking that the Russian Jews live downtown and the German Jews live uptown. Well, that's true to an extent. But at least as far as Harlem is concerned, if you put aside Yorkville and the Upper East Side, the Germans came first, but the Russians followed shortly thereafter and overpowered them and dominated them numerically. Okay. People tend to think that Jews moved to Harlem as part of their economic and social advancement, that Harlem was the goal. You know, you wanted to escape from Ludlow Street or Rivington Street. So you wanted to go up to Harlem. That was the goal. Well, that was only true for one segment of the Harlem Jewry that arrived for the most part after the year 1903 and went west of Madison Avenue. That was not true for the first and largest group of Russian Jews who moved to Harlem, that many of them moved in the hopes of material improvement, not because they actually had succeeded in having material improvement. There's a big difference between the two. One is I have dollars in my pocket, I'll go to over there. The other is I want dollars in my pocket, so I'll pick up myself up and move there in the hopes of a better life. Okay. What would happen in Harlem? So Jews could work near home and have better accommodations than they did downtown for only slightly more money. So you get more bang for your buck in terms of your apartment unit. Thousands of others never bothered to go downtown. And this is an important thing to remember in the history of American Jewish life, that not everybody went to the Lower East Side. Even those who went to New York, some people went directly to what we call areas of second settlement. That, yes, Harlem is an area of second settlement in the sense that for the original arrivals, the first area of settlement was downtown. But for some people who never went downtown, it was their first area of settlement. So it's not the same for all families. I mean, for example, at least in my family, 100 years ago, they were in Brownsville, but that was their area of first settlement, even though Brownsville is normally regarded as an area of second settlement because people went there after having left the Lower East Side. Okay, so low-wage workers did not tend to commute back downtown. Why not? Because they didn't want to waste an hour or more on the train both ways. You know, they're earning 15 cents an hour, and to kill an hour on the train means you're losing parnassa. It also means you have to get up earlier because you have to get to work really early. So who wants to get up at 4:30 in the morning and waste your time on the train and lose parnassa? That's why the commute back and forth to Harlem from downtown or commute to downtown from Harlem really didn't have much of an appeal in the Jewish community. So who was moving uptown? Upwardly mobile Russian Jews were slow to move to Harlem. Construction workers did move, and then there was a change in the real estate market. The plan for the subway was passed by the legislature in 1894. It was eventually completed in 1904, but for a decade it was in the works. And the idea was, well, we're going to create a lot of housing stock uptown near where the subway stations are going to be, and everyone's going to want to move there. So that's a reason to point your eyes northward. Residential bargain hunters and in the buildings trades went up there looking for work. They figured, I'll find a job there. I'll get my parnassa in building one of these new buildings. Downtown residential buildings were being torn down to make room for factories and public parks. By 1900, there were 17,000 Russian Jews in Harlem. West of Lexington Avenue, most of them were white-collar professionals. The Eastern District was the working class. And a third of all the skilled workers in the Eastern District were in the building trades. In the decade that followed, another 80,000 Russian Jews moved to Harlem. So it'd be 100,000 by 1910. By 1910, Harlem was the largest concentration of Eastern European Jews in the world outside of Warsaw and the Lower East Side. So Harlem was a big Jewish neighborhood. People forget this, but it was tremendous. At the high point, it was 178,000 in 1921. So What was destroying the absorptive capacity of the downtown community that led to Harlem's renaissance? Well, the downtown community had its residential capacity limited by a few things. One was slum clearance. Another was municipal improvements, building code regulations, and business incursion into residential areas. The 1902 tenement law required that there be direct sunlight in every room in the building. So Eli's asking, what was Jewish life like? We'll get to that. Don't worry, we'll get to that. So the 1902 tenement law really took away a lot of housing stock on the Lower East Side. You had to make things livable, direct sunlight, and toilets for every apartment. You'd think that's an important thing, a toilet in every apartment. Also, there were many, many buildings destroyed to make way for the Manhattan Bridge and the Williamsburg Bridge. And yet more Jews were coming every year. Remember, as this is happening, you have the Kishinev pogrom and the failed Russian Revolution of 1905. and Jews are coming in the largest numbers in the years 1904, 5, and 6. So where are these people going to go? There's less, there are less units available downtown. More Jews are coming. They got to go somewhere. Either the veterans have to leave and find a new neighborhood, or even the Greenhorns themselves have to plop themselves down somewhere other than the Lower East Side. So veteran Jews of the Lower East Side go to Brownsville, Williamsburg, and Harlem. Jews start investing in Harlem. And then there was a machlokus, there was a conflict between those who viewed Harlem as an investment opportunity and those who saw it as a place to live. Those who saw it as an investment opportunity were happy to see the rates go up, 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 and make big parnassa and dollars in their pocket. But those who actually wanted to live there didn't want to waste all their income on rent. So there were rent gouging and there were rent strikes. Not necessarily the best situation for intra-Jewish affairs. What about the blacks? Blacks were in northwestern Harlem and didn't come down to lower central and eastern Harlem until after World War I. East Harlem's more affluent residents fled to central Harlem to avoid the newly arrived Russian Jewish greenhorns. You know, remember, the German Jews don't like the Russian Jews. They're backward and barbaric, you know. So if you lived in east of Third Avenue and you were a Yekki, and all of a sudden it's 1905 and a whole bunch of Ostjuden are coming, what do? You move to Park Avenue, Madison Avenue, Fifth Avenue, Lenox Avenue. You get away from them. Okay. Southeastern Harlem, east of Third Avenue and just north of 96th Street, was, quote, for a class of Jews who want to live uptown but can't afford uptown rent. In other words, it's a way of being uptown without really being uptown. It's fake uptown. That was southeastern Harlem, you know, just north of where the 95th Street Shul is, Or HaChaim. What we see from the Harlem example is that New York City did not follow the Chicago pattern of areas of first settlement. But rather, people in the second areas of settlement did not necessarily discard their cultural baggage, and you could have an area which was at the same time both for greenhorns and for veterans. Okay. Those who moved to Harlem to break free of the bonds of the ghetto were one group, but there was another group that moved out of economic necessity and still wanted an all-pervasive ghetto Jewish environment, a culture. The ghetto was to them a fortress as much as it was a prison. And beneath the hated squalor was the beloved Jewish vibe or Jewish atmosphere. And so in creating a second Jewish ghetto in New York City, Harlem had its Landsmannschaft synagogues, its Talmud Torah movement, its socialist clubs, its radical clubs. It had it all. All the stuff you had downtown was recreated uptown for people who wanted it, who were not thoroughly Americanized. Okay, they had your socialism, you had your orthodoxy. Those are the two things that Jews love, religion and socialism. Okay, now the Arbiter Ring was the socialist's home away from home. The young socialists in Harlem were miserable until the Arbiter Ring established branch number 2 uptown. Also what happened for the first time in Harlem was the socialist Jewish Sunday schools. Now, someone can chime in, unmute yourself. Did any of you go to the Schuller, to the socialist Jewish schools when you were a kid, Sunday school, after the communist or socialist Talmud Torahs? Anybody? No? Okay, so at Anshe Sholem, there are some of us, of our older members, who as children, remember being sent not to a regular religious Talmud Torah, but going to an Arbiter Ring school, the Schuller. Okay, they had them in many different places all over New York City. And what did you learn in these places? You learned Yiddish, and you learned socialist values, and you learned how to be an American citizen. But what you didn't learn was how to wrap tefillin. So if you wanted bar mitzvah, you had to jump ship and go to the shul. Okay. So the first one was in Harlem, and after that, many were established all over the city. The Workman's Circle paid sick benefits and death benefits, and so people liked it as a important safety net, social safety net. Socialist culture was pro-Yiddish and Jewish nationalist. This is important. You know, some Jewish socialists were anti-Yiddish and wanted, you know, Russification in Russia and thorough Americanization in America, but to a socialist America. In downtown, in the Lower East Side, the Educational Alliance at first opposed Yiddish And even the socialists opposed Yiddish. But in Harlem, they were more Yiddishkeit. There was more Jewish flavor to them. There was also the Bund and the social, the Pole Zion, which was a Zionist version of the Bund, all after 1905. So every permutation of Zionism and socialism and religion and irreligion found an expression in Harlem. The public tended to favor socialist agitation only insofar as they benefited on a specific consumer issue, like kosher meat prices or baked good prices. But the socialists found that they could not develop a grassroots constituency and movement uptown in Harlem that would sustain itself for the long haul. That on specific issues, people were willing to be pleased with their efforts, but only if they could benefit materially. Okay. What about politically? So politically, Harlem's Jews voted like the rest of the population. Some voted for the Republicans and some voted for the Tammany Democrats. The Socialist Party could not get much traction. Why not? As I mentioned a few weeks ago, because many of the people were not citizens yet, and they couldn't vote. Alternatively, they didn't realize the importance of voting. So in 1916, the socialist Morris Hillquit ran for Congress, and the incumbent was Isaac Siegel, a Jewish Republican. And Siegel defeated Hillquit in 1916 and 1918 and 1920, but Hillquit kept doing better and better, at least among the Jews. The broader electorate, which included a lot of Italians, primarily voted for the non-socialist Isaac Siegel. The third party candidate was the Tammany Democrat, Bernard Rosenblatt, whose claim to fame was that he was a Zionist and wanted all Jews to vote for him because he's a Zionist. But that doesn't always work itself out. Okay. Hillquit was accused by Siegel of being a carpetbagger from downtown who doesn't know the real needs of uptown Jewry. It reminds me of what people said about Hillary Clinton in 2000 when she ran for the Senate, you know, carpetbagger. So, resettlement to Harlem was a station on the main line of progress towards entering the main body of American citizenship. And Harlem-bound Jews, some of them at least, were committed to rapid acculturation. But there was a pernicious byproduct of that rapid acculturation. And that is people equated Judaism with old world, outdated ghetto culture and were willing and eager to discard it to become real Americans. So the question was, how do you get people to think of Judaism in better terms? That it's not just something of the past that we jettison when we become good citizens of America, but rather that we can maintain as part of our identity and a deeply felt part of our identity, even as we become full-fledged Americans. So the Uptown Talmud Torah and the Rabbi Yisrael Salanter Talmud Torah were the first institutions to try to create an American form of Orthodox Judaism in America. And here we see that areas of second settlement did not have to only be about rapid acculturation. They could also be a place for strengthening your ethnic and religious identity. So one of the motivating factors in getting people excited about Jewish culture and religious identity was a report in the newspapers in December of 1903 that something really bad happened. What, from a religious point of view, who can tell me what's a really bad thing to happen from a religious point of view? What's really bad? Anybody? Nobody?
Pogroms?
Intermarriage.
Okay, intermarriage is pretty bad. What's even worse than intermarriage?
Converting to Christianity.
Converting to another religion. Bingo. Good, good. So converting to another religion. So in 1903... newspaper reports came out that said that Christian missionaries in Harlem were finding a significant degree of success among young Jews. And that scared people, even among the Reform and even among the assimilated. The idea that we're going to be mishumadim, convert out to Christianity, it can't be. We can't let that stand. So there were few institutions in Harlem that were actually furthering American Judaism. You had the cultural clubs like the Chesterfield Club and the Russian American Hebrew Association, which were nice clubs, but they weren't doing anything to promote positive Jewish religious identity. The Landsmannschaft Schools and the Chadorim, you know, the old cheders, they were promoting old world religion that didn't speak to the hearts and minds of the American born kids. So you had, you know, assimilationist Jewish clubs on one hand, old world religion on the other, but neither one serves the purpose of American Judaism. So what are you going to do? How do we save the so-called rising generation in Israel, as they were known, the rising generation in Israel? The cheder was a relic of the past and was doomed to fail. The Landsmannschaft Schul was a one-generation stopgap measure that provided nostalgia. It survived on the nostalgia for the one generation that liked it. But there was no way that a second generation was going to have any liking to it. There's a question, was the 1903 report true? The answer is it was overblown. There were some cases of apostasy, but not very many. In the long history of American Judaism, there's hardly much of a history of converting out. There's a lot of assimilation, there's a lot of intermarriage, but not a lot of converting out. Okay. So the more affluent among the Jews of Harlem built big synagogues like OZ and KAJ. The major attraction at OZ was Cantor Yossele Rosenblatt. Now, the rabbi was Philip Hillel Klein, and the assistant rabbi was Bernard Drachman. He was brought in to give English language sermons because Klein spoke in Hungarian. But the attraction was Yossele Rosenblatt. But most people didn't go to the big cathedral synagogues in Harlem, certainly not the Orthodox ones. It catered to a clientele, but it was a relatively small clientele. The unacculturated parents sent their kids to the Malamed in the Cheder. The kids were bored stiff, and they wanted to run away. And the acculturated parents avoided the Chadarim altogether, and the kids got no Jewish education. So what solutions are there to the problem of maintaining Jewish ethnic identity in this neighborhood? So one solution is the Harlem Jewish Federation, which was established in 1903 and was dedicated to both the acculturation of the Jews and preservation of their group identity. They held classes in a bunch of different shuls, and they held Saturday afternoon services when people could go, even if they worked Saturday morning. The Harlem Federation was like an uptown version of the Educational Alliance, but the difference was it wasn't anti-Yiddish. The library and recreational facilities were made available to non-Jews. Why aren't we trying to preserve group identity? Why are we inviting the non-Jews into our recreational facilities? The answer is b'pnei darkei shalom. We want to preserve the peace. We want to preserve the peace. Okay. Well, now let's talk about Talmud Torahs. The Uptown Talmud Torah was founded in 1892. It always had financial problems. As a Talmud Torah, it was a charity school. You didn't pay, there was no tuition. It was for the poor families that their kids should get some cheder instruction. By 1902, it only had four teachers and 200 students. It was in an unsanitary building with very poor ventilation. And the kids merely learned some siddur and a bit of chumash. Well, you can't preserve Judaism with just some rote siddur and a little drop of chumash. That's not going to get it done. The principal was Rabbi Moses Reicherson, and he was one of those submerged scholars. He was a disciple of Yehuda Leib Gordon. He was a real muskel. In fact, he was an expert grammarian. And here he was teaching Aleph Beis to ignorant kids in Harlem when he should have been a big scholar, a big chacham. And he died young. His successor was Tzvi Malachovsky. And Malachovsky's chiddush, his contribution to the development of the Talmud Torahs in America, was that there should be a leveled system. Not that everybody's in the room at the same time learning the same thing, regardless of age differences and differences in what they've already learned, but rather three levels, grade A, B, and C. At the first level, you learn elementary stuff, and the instruction would be in the English language. Why the English language? Because the kids don't know anything else. Maybe they speak Yiddish at the home with their parents, but for the most part, these are public school kids who in the afternoon are getting some religion. You teach them in English. The second level would be Ivrit for Ivrit, or at least we would encourage Ivrit be Ivrit, Judaic studies in the Hebrew language. Of course, that requires some elementary preparation in the first stage to get to that second stage, but that was the ideal. And at the third level, where they would finally get around to the Talmud, would be only for the five percenters. What are the five percenters? Those are the kids who we anticipate they might have a future for themselves in Jewish education and the rabbinate. If they're going to advance in the ethnic economy to work as religious workers, clay kodesh, they go to the third level, the five percenters. Okay. In 1905, there was a merger between the Uptown Talmud Torah and the Harlem Educational Institute for improving the financial prospects of both groups. And they emerged as the Uptown Talmud Torah Association. The promise was that there would be no non-sectarianism. Non-sectarianism is when educational alliance type institutions teach people, you know, to be an American, to be a good citizen. They give courses and this, that, the other thing, but they don't hit you over the head with doctrine, with real religion. And the fear was that if the Talmud Torah combined with an educational institution uptown in Harlem that was like, you know, these non-sectarian groups, then it was going to water down the Judaic curriculum of the Talmud Torah. So the promise was, no, that's not going to happen. No non-sectarianism. This is going to be an Orthodox Talmud Torah through and through. Okay. Well, they had a new building that was built on 111th Street. And by 1908, they had 700 students. It was big, huge. And support came from a wide range of places, including Jacob Schiff, Daddy Warbucks himself, okay, the granddaddy of all the Jewish rich guys, the Ramaz, or Rosh Yisvul and Margulies, and Henry Pereira Mendes, the rabbi of Sherith Israel, Spanish Portuguese. So the Reform wealthy and the Orthodox rabbis of the East Side and the West Side, Ashkenazic and Sephardic alike, understood that if Harlem Jewry was going to survive as a serious Jewish community, they had to educate their kids in Torah somehow, and the Uptown Talmud Torah was going to be the major institution. The Talmud Torah came up with an interesting idea, and that was a standardized curriculum for all New York City Talmud Torahs. Halavai, that should have happened. You know, what was the reason for this idea? Well, I mean, people move around. There's residential mobility, and if you were to live in one neighborhood when the kid is in third grade, and a different neighborhood when the kid is in fourth grade, and a different neighborhood kid in the fifth grade, every year you're moving because of economic circumstances or because the, you know, the urban environment changes. How is your kid's Jewish education going to advance in an appropriate way? You know, the public schools, they have a system, first grade, second grade, third grade, you have an official curriculum. If the Jewish schools don't do the same, the kid's going to be all over the place on his Jewish learning. Okay, did the rabbi, so Eli's asking, did the rabbis encourage the people to send their kids to Talmud Torah? The answer is absolutely, unless you were the kind of person who wanted your kid to get a yeshiva education. And after 1907, we shall see there were yeshivot. We'll get to that shortly. We'll get to that. Okay, so the idea of the standardized education in the Talmud Torahs was something that would be adopted and furthered by the New York Keilah's Board of Jewish Education, the BJE. And for the next, you know, 100 years, there'd be some progress on those fronts. I mean, everybody who knows, went to school in the day schools of America, knows what happens. In first grade, you have the Siddur play. In second grade, you have the Chumash play. In third grade, you learn Rashi script. In fourth grade, you start learning Sefer Yoshua. In fifth grade, you start learning Mishnah. In sixth grade, you learn Hamafkid in the Gemara. So there's a certain rhyme and reason to day school and Talmud Torah education that developed in America over time, but it didn't exist in 1905. We just know of it today because we've experienced it, those of us who went through the system. Okay. Well, there were old world parents, you know, from old world parents who didn't like modern methods of pedagogy and didn't trust the Reformed Jews not to tinker with the religious curriculum. If you recall from a couple of weeks ago, I told the story of Harry Fischel buying the slide machine to show pictures for the Bible class, and that some parent came in and destroyed the machine. Okay. By 1911, there were 8,000 local Jews benefiting from the facilities of the Uptown Talmud Torah, meaning children and adults alike, 8,000. There were 1,700 kids learning in the Talmud Torah proper. That's a tremendous number. Okay. Harry Fischel, the Orthodox version of Jacob Schiff, was responsible for the establishment of the Rich Man's Annex to the Uptown Talmud Torah. Now, what is the Rich Man's Annex? Of course, it wasn't actually called that. It wasn't called the Rich Man's Annex, but that's what popularly it was known as. Well, the issue was this. Wealthy people were being hit up for contributions to support this institution because the parents didn't pay. So you need money to fund this institution. The wealthy were giving money, but the wealthy lived where? They lived in central Harlem near Fifth Avenue, Lenox Avenue, Seventh Avenue, or at least, you know, west of Park Avenue for sure. And they lived further north. So they were far away, and their kids were not getting a Talmud Torah education. So Fischel's idea was, you know, we're developing a bunch of rich Amoratsim, that we're the funders of the school, but our kids know nothing. So we have to have a branch of the school where the rich kids are going to learn. But the wealthy Jews were loath to send their kids to a charity school. So they made a policy, you pay $3 a month. It's not charity. You pay some abyssal tuition. Okay. Someone's asking, what credentials did the teachers have? Norman is asking that. So the answer is that many of the teachers were coming from the JTS and the Teachers Institute of JTS, which was just then established under Kaplan's auspices. But other teachers were just malamdin from the old world. But if they spoke a good enough English, they could teach in the Uptown Talmud Torah. Okay. So Rabbi Yisrael Salanter Talmud Torah was established in 1909 to serve the needs of northern Harlem. Rabbi Shmaria Leib Hurwitz immediately had this Salanter school join the Board of Jewish Education, and he believed in the standardized curriculum, again, because of the issue of mobility. And every time the kid advances a grade, if he's moving to a different school, he's not going to know what they're learning in school. By 1915, Salanter had 800 students. It's a big Talmud Torah. Well, what about yeshivas? You know, Talmud Torah is one thing, but a yeshiva is another altogether. And there were always going to be some families that insisted that their boys receive a stronger and a more intensive Jewish education. So after 1907, there were yeshiva day schools. Yeshiva Rabbi Elijah Gaon Mivilna, the Vilna Gaon, was first established, and then quickly it split into two different schools. The old world yeshivish place, which eschewed any modern pedagogical methods, was named Yeshiva Toras Chaim, and they had the bare minimum of state requirement for secular education. The modern Orthodox school was named the Yeshiva of Harlem, the Yeshiva de Harlem. And there, at the modern Orthodox school, it was half a day Jewish studies and half a day secular studies. The functional equivalent of that downtown was RJJ. And after 1906, Chaim Berlin in Brownsville, and after 1917, Tor Vadas in Williamsburg. So those were the essentially modern Orthodox day schools. The irony is that Chaim Berlin and Tor Vadas began as modern Orthodox day schools. So how to counter assimilation? That's the big question. So we have our Talmud Torahs, and we have our yeshivas, and the yeshivas are really playing a marginal role. But how do you counter the assimilation? So the answer would ultimately be Mordechai Kaplan's Synagogue Center. And we're going to talk about that at much more length. Well, we have in years past, but we'll talk about it at some length when we discuss the interwar period, the 20s and 30s. But Kaplan was preceded in this regard by Herbert Goldstein's Institutional Synagogue of Harlem, which was established in 1917. And it was the experimental laboratory for the Synagogue Center concept. There was an earlier attempt at a youth synagogue, an Americanized Orthodox youth-oriented synagogue in Harlem in the first decade of the 20th century. In 1905, under the leadership of Rabbi Henry Moraes, who was the son of Rabbi Sabato Moraes, the original founder of JTS. And it was called Congregation Mikveh Israel. But it failed. And why did it fail? It was a half a generation too early. You know, there was a problem that the rabbis had. What was the problem? In the late 19th century and early 20th century, there were many, or not many, but there were some conservative and Orthodox and conservadox rabbis, graduates of JTS, graduates of JTS of New York, graduates of JTS of Breslau in Germany, graduates of the Hildesheimer Yeshiva in Berlin, or just rabbis with some kind of modern credentials who came to the New York area and America more broadly, but we're talking about New York, and were looking for pulpits but couldn't find any. Because what was religion in those years? Religion was either Reform or immigrant Orthodox. An Americanized traditional Judaism needed to exist, but didn't really have an audience for it yet, because the Eastern European Jews had yet to acculturate enough to want an Americanized form of religion. Well, these guys who were looking for an audience, you know, went snooping around downtown, an uptown, looking for people to latch onto. And Moraes failed early on. But around 1910, things changed. Several of the major synagogues in Harlem hired JTS graduates, either as their lead rabbi or at least as an underling rabbi to serve along with the old world rabbi. And the goal was to satisfy the needs of those people who didn't want a Yiddish language drasha or didn't want a Hungarian or German language sermon. They wanted an English sermon and they wanted Americanized Judaism. So the fact that pulpits opened up in Harlem was a welcome development, a very positive development for the traditional Americanized rabbinate. It says we have a future. You know, they're hiring us. We could get a job. Well, in 1915, the Harlem Young Men's Hebrew Orthodox League was founded. The Young Men Hebrew Orthodox League. Why was it founded? Well, it became apparent that even if you were a Talmud Torah graduate, you needed some chizuk. Why? Because Talmud Torah graduates were beginning to become disaffected from Judaism when they went into academia and the workforce. In other words, think about it this way. If you had no Jewish education as a kid, and now you're in your 20s or early 30s, you're starting a family, all right, so it's going to be hard for the synagogues and the Jewish institutions to attract your attention and to grab you for the long haul. But you know what? Even the people who went to Talmud Torah, who are now working and are long away from their Jewish studies as a youth, they also might slip away. I mean, to be honest, we find this today in American Jewish society, that day school education, K through 12 day school education is no panacea. Plenty of kids who I went to school with for 12 years, North Hebrew Academy and Hafter, now behave like they're outright goyim, whether in their marriage choices, their religious profile, and their non-involvement in Jewish life. So it's a sad truth. But this was true about Talmud Torah, 100 years ago, 105 years ago. So you need to reinforce their Judaism with classes, interesting classes, and modernized services, modernized shul services. Kaplan complained that the YMHA was terrible, that YMHA should really just be YMA, drop the H, don't have it be a charade. It's a scam. There's no Hebrew content. There's no Jewish content to the YMHA. So either they should drop the H or introduce real Judaic content. His viewpoint was, what are we going to do? We're going to have a center. And that center, which is going to be a synagogue center, will combine the ruchniut and the gashmiut, the spirituality and the physicality of Jewish communal life. So in other words, the shul with the pool or the gymnasium, and people will come for the gashmiut, for the physicality, and eventually mosey on into the ruchniut. In other words, you come to use the gym and you'll notice the davening mincha will stop and be the ninth man, 10th man in the minyan. That was his brilliant chachma. Did it work? In some places, yes. Most of the time, not really. Okay. So the Central Jewish Institute was established as an adjunct to KJ in Yorkville in 1913, and it was the synagogue center idea minus the synagogue. And Herbert Goldstein was the one who ran it for a few years as a young assistant rabbi to the Ramaz. But by 1917, it was finished. And Goldstein moved to Harlem, and Kaplan, who had been his predecessor as the associate rabbi at KJ, went to the West Side to found the Jewish Center. Goldstein's father-in-law was Harry Fischel. So that meant that Herbert Goldstein had some funding, some financial backing to start his adventure in Harlem. And an adventure it sure would be. It lasted only a decade, not even, but it had a tremendous impact. So Goldstein, Rabbi Herbert Goldstein, wanted to have the shul, the Talmud Torah, and the YMHA all under one umbrella organization of the institutional synagogue. And he goes up to Harlem in the spring of 1917 and very quickly finds a captive audience. Big captive audience. So I know a Reform rabbi called this treadmill Judaism. That's funny. I never heard of that before. Treadmill Judaism. Okay. So he goes up to Harlem and he has these revival meetings or what he calls monster rallies. When I think of monster rally, I think of a monster truck in Nassau Coliseum, but all right. So big rallies. And by Rosh Hashanah of 1917, he has 1,200 people in rented space in Harlem for high holiday services. So he was like the Rebbetzin Yester Youngreis of his time. There was big gatherings, revivalist meetings. Okay. Well, someone donated to him a building on 116th Street, which did him a big favor, a five-story building. So he was able to have a leg up on establishing a physical synagogue presence. And he established an employment bureau. Why? To encourage people to hire those who were Shomer Shabbos. And he went around all 116th Street and 125th Street and 110th Street, encouraging the shop owners to close their stores on Saturday. Why? We have to have a Jewish atmosphere in Harlem. He wanted a Yiddish atmosphere, Orthodox atmosphere in Harlem. It never had that before, and he wanted to create it. All right, very nice of him. So he's a real go-getter in terms of turning around the neighborhood religiously. Well, there were some people who didn't like his revivalism, and they felt that it was un-Jewish, and they said that the Jewish community didn't need a Billy Sunday. Billy Sunday being a Christian, actually he was a former ball player who became on to become like a televangelist. Okay, so we don't need that among our people. Rabbi Goldstein's response was, revivalism is not a new thing to Judaism, that the prophets of old were revivalists. And so were the Magidim of Eastern Europe. The itinerant Magidim would go around giving sermons. They were revivalists. Okay. Someone asked, am I going to talk about the Black Cantors of Harlem? So I'm actually not going to discuss that tonight, or maybe at all. It's an interesting subtopic, the Black Cantors. It's not really relevant to the Jewish community per se. It was relevant to the Black Hebrew community. Okay. Eli says, it sounds like the early years of Young Israel. Yes. So the early years of Young Israel downtown, which was established in 1912, was for the same purpose, to reinvigorate a modernized orthodoxy. And that's what Goldstein was doing up in Harlem and later the Upper West Side. Okay, so the lessons that were learned from the modern Orthodox experience in Harlem and uptown would later be applied to the conservative synagogues in the suburbs. So lest you think that conservative Judaism had a sort of monopoly, an early monopoly on Americanized traditional Judaism, and only later on did the Orthodox emerge, not true. There was a modernized orthodoxy before there was any relevant conservative Judaism. Okay, so the theory that urban neighborhoods experience invasion by a new ethnic group and then succession was the dominant theory in historical writing. And it's known as the Burgess-Cressy-Wirth School of Urban Studies, that you have invasion and succession. However, there's another school of thought in urban studies, of the Duncan and Tauber school of thought, which says that it's a four-step process. The first step is penetration by a new group to the terrain of another group. Then invasion, large numbers. Then concentration or consolidation. And lastly, piling up. And in each phase, the outgoing group moves on out, but not in one step. It takes time. It may take even decades for this process to play itself out. In Harlem, the four-step process is what actually happened, not the invasion and succession rapid-fire version. Blacks first came to Harlem in the early days of the 20th century, and even before the 20th century, in the 1890s, to escape the Tenderloin section of Manhattan. The Tenderloin section was between 24th Street and 42nd Street and was basically a vice-ridden area. And it was bad. It was crime-ridden. People wanted out. So they move up to Harlem, the northernmost reaches of Harlem, just as the Jews were moving from the Lower East Side to Eastern and Central Harlem. So it's a simultaneous thing where Blacks and Jews are both moving uptown. The Black penetration into Jewish areas did not really start until after 1905. And it was not on a major scale until after World War I. After the war, Harlem very quickly became a deteriorating ghetto. Now, why did this happen? So let me explain what happened. Severe wartime overcrowding was the result of the absence of construction. It came to a standstill. Materials, construction materials, were very hard to come by. They were needed for the war effort. And so for residential purposes in the urban environment, you were not having new construction. So that means that there's an undersupply. And also, people are moving in. Who's moving in? Blacks from the South. And by the thousands and hundreds of thousands are moving to the North, including to New York, during the war and especially after the war in even greater numbers. So this is the major exodus from the South and movement to the North. Physical deterioration of the buildings, the residential buildings, soon followed because landlords knew that they could charge whatever they wanted and people had to pay it. They needed a place to live. They had nowhere else to go. So if the landlord can charge you whatever they want and they're not afraid of losing a tenant, then if there's a leaky faucet, they're not so quick to fix it. They don't bother investing in their own buildings. So the buildings go to hell. And it was unpleasant to live in Harlem, a neighborhood that had been a nice sort of middle-class neighborhood, you know, central Harlem, or certainly north central Harlem was a very, very nice area. Even the nice parts of Harlem started to decline as they became overcrowded. Okay, where can people go? So where are people going to go if they want to leave what had been the great second area of settlement that was Harlem? So they can go to the West Side. They can go to the Bronx. They can go to Astoria, Jackson Heights, okay, Brooklyn, various neighborhoods in Brooklyn. What's going to happen? The answer is that Manhattan is going to be a home for the very wealthy and the very poor. But as for those folks in the middle, the middle class, even the lower middle class, are going to end up going elsewhere to the outer boroughs because the outer boroughs offer them a better quality of life. Immigration laws also play another role, and we're going to spend a whole week, a whole session on the immigration laws, why they happened, and what was the sentiment in the United States about nativist sentiment about restricting newcomers from undesirable parts of the world, like Southern Europe and Eastern Europe and the Jews and the Italians, okay? We're going to talk about that at length. So where are people going to go? The answer is that they're going to go elsewhere, but who's going to replace them? Well, not Jews, because if the immigration laws are restricting Eastern European immigration to America, then the tradition, which had been that Jews arrive in a neighborhood, they make some money, more Jews arrive after them, sort of make the neighborhood undesirable, the ones with money move away, whether north or east or west, and then the cycle continues. Every time people move in or move out, someone else moves in. But it's always Jews because there's always an influx of Jews. Well, now there isn't going to be an influx of Jews. So all the old line first areas of settlement and second areas of settlement are going to lose Jewish population in the immediate post-World War I era. What am I talking about? Four neighborhoods. The Lower East Side itself, you know, the granddaddy of all the ghettos, Harlem, Williamsburg, and Brownsville are all going to significantly lose Jewish population in the post-war era, post-World War I era, because it's not so desirable anymore. And there are other places that are more desirable. And there are Jews who are not coming to follow them in their footsteps to take up their old homes. So who's going to follow in their footsteps? Instead, it's going to be Blacks and, in some cases, Puerto Ricans and other ethnic groups, mostly Blacks and Hispanics. So what happens to Harlem Jewry by the numbers? In 1921, there were 178,000 Jews in Harlem, a tremendous number, the high point. By 1923, it was down to 168,000. So people knew this didn't look very good. You know, if you had invested a great deal, whether in your business, in your personal property or your residential property, or in your synagogue and your religious institutions, you were nervous that, well, we built all this up in the last decade and a half. To what end? To see it all crumble? People got really nervous. You know, they spent so much money and time and effort on it. So in 1925, the number was down to 123,000, a tremendous drop off in 2 years of about 45,000 Jews. By 1927, 2 years later, it was down to 88,000. By 1930, it was down to 25,000. And some say it was only 5,000. So basically from 1921 to 1930, you went from 178,000 Jews to about somewhere between 5 and 25,000. It killed the Jewish community of Harlem. The 1920s, the Roaring Twenties, was the death knell for Jewish Harlem. Well, why did they leave? So it's important that people understand that Jews did not leave Harlem
because they were running away from blacks. You know, there's a tendency to think that just because whenever you have one ethnic group that was in an area and is followed by a different ethnic group and there's a tremendous turnover in a hurry, the assumption is white flight or some kind of flight. And yes, there was flight, but not for racial reasons. And how do we know it's not for racial reasons? Because there had been two decades of Jews and blacks living together in Harlem prior to the so-called white flight. Now, granted, they weren't necessarily on top of each other. There was an obvious black area and obviously Jewish areas, poor Jewish area, middle-class Jewish area, wealthy Jewish area, but there was intermingling. And there were certain, and there was a Jewish presence in the black part of Harlem. There were several thousand Jews who lived in northwestern Harlem in the black areas. And obviously they had no problem of racial tension. So it was not an example of racial animus or bias. Rather, it's just that the neighborhood wasn't great anymore. It was getting bad. And there are other options, and there are other options that are just as more affordable, or maybe just slightly more expensive, but you get more bang for your buck. So where did people move to? The answer is they moved everywhere. But if we wanted to identify certain trends, those who lived in the northern parts of Harlem did the simple thing. They just moved further north. Where? To what neighborhood?
In the Bronx.
Washington Heights. So the jump from the 120s or the 130s to 158th Street in St. Nicholas is not that big of a jump. And then from 158th in St. Nicholas, you can go up to the 170s and 180s, which was the heart of the Jewish Washington Heights area in the interwar period. Well, that's one way. What about if you were living in central Harlem or bordering on the western reaches of Harlem towards Morningside Heights? Where might you go?
To the Bronx.
Upper West Side.
Down. Upper West Side.
Now, what about if you were living in East Harlem? Where would you go? Bronx.
The Bronx.
So some went to Parkchester. Yes, Eli, some went to Parkchester. Some went to the Grand Concourse. Some went to Morrisania, Hunts Point. I mean, all over the place. But the Grand Concourse was the most popular destination for those who left Harlem to go to the Bronx. So these are some of the residential choices that people had. But even though those all make sense in the sense that, it's a quick jump, West Harlem to West Side, North Harlem to Washington Heights, East Harlem to the Bronx, it makes sense. It's connected. There were also people who just moved to Brooklyn, who moved to Crown Heights, who moved to Flatbush, or moved to Borough Park. And some people even moved to Queens, what was the heart of Jewish Queens in the post-World War II era, which was, northeast Queens, where my family comes from, but rather like northwest Queens, Astoria, Jackson Heights area, that became heavily Jewish in the immediate post-World War I era. And so people had these various options. And I think when we discuss the interwar period, we'll spend some time discussing those other neighborhoods that we didn't get to that are not Manhattan neighborhoods. And we did a lot of Lower East Side. We did Harlem. And we mentioned in passing Upper East Side, Yorkville. We'll get to some of these other neighborhoods when we discuss At Home in America, Deborah Dash Moore's discussion of second-generation Jews in New York, which is mostly an interwar period book. But that's not going to be for a few weeks, because next week I want to discuss Louis Brandeis and American Zionism, the early phases of American Zionism. So his political career and judicial career, plus his involvement in the Federation of American Zionists. So that'll be next week. And the week after that, God willing, we'll discuss Jewish participation in World War I from the standpoint of the soldiers and the home front, what life was like as new Americans, but fighting a war for Uncle Sam. Okay, so everybody have a great week, and I'll see you all next week. Okay, take care.
Thank you very much.
Good
night.
Good night.